That's coming up at 10:30. I'll be your host for Headwaters today. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Our weather for today, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest, 5 to 15, partly cloudy tonight, lows 41 to 45, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76. Support comes from Edward Jones Financial Advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota, and operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for your support. Up next, it's news headlines from National Public Radio.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. The man illegally deported to a prison in El Salvador this year and then returned to the U.S. has been detained again by immigration officials. Kilmar Abrego Garcia reported to an immigration office in Baltimore, Maryland this morning. Before surrendering, he spoke of the brief time he had this weekend back with his family. Abrego Garcia is heard here through an interpreter provided by one of the groups that helped organize this gathering.
Quedarán grabadas para el resto de mi vida.
When I was finally able to reunite with my family, all of those emotions, all of those memories will be forever ingrained in me.
Federal officials wanted Abrego Garcia to plead guilty to human smuggling, but he refused. Now, federal immigration officials say they may deport him again, but this time to Uganda. President Trump is threatening to send more military deployments to democratically run cities. He has said Chicago, New York, and possibly Baltimore could follow Washington, D.C. in having a military presence. NPR's Ashley Lopez has more.
Trump recently announced Chicago could be the next city in which he will deploy active duty troops for an alleged crackdown on crime. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a statement Saturday that the state has not yet received any request or outreach from the federal government. Pritzker said there's no emergency in the state that warrants this kind of intervention. He accused Trump of manufacturing a crisis and abusing his power. In a Truth Social post Sunday, Trump also went after Maryland's governor and threatened to send troops to Baltimore. Trump also wrote he'd now have to rethink federal funding to repair Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, which was demolished by a cargo ship in 2024. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Researchers at the University of Michigan say that fully electric vehicles have lower lifetime emissions than any other vehicle type in every county in the contiguous United States. As NPR's Camilla Domonoski reports, this contributes to a body of research that finds EVs are generally cleaner than gas cars.
Electric vehicles cost a lot of energy to produce. Their efficiency varies based on the temperature, and the electricity they rely on is only as clean as the electric grid. The UM researchers factored all of that in and found that over their lifetime, EVs are better for the climate than gas, hybrid, or plug-in hybrid vehicles. They did not compare them to alternatives to driving. The paper was published in Environmental Science and Technology. It noted small EVs with modest batteries were the cleanest, but pickup drivers could see the biggest drop in emissions from going electric, a 75% decrease. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
Hospital officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks on a hospital there today have killed at least 21 people. Four of the dead are journalists who were working for international news organizations. That includes Reuters and the Associated Press. This is NPR. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says there's no meeting yet scheduled between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. Speaking to NBC, Lavrov says before any meeting can happen, the leaders need an agenda, and he says there's no agenda in place. His statement seems to contradict efforts by President Trump to arrange a meeting between the Ukrainian and Russian leaders. It was 50 years ago today, rock star Bruce Springsteen released his Born to Run album. NPR's Isabel Gomez Sarmiento has more.
Columbia Records was getting ready to drop Bruce Springsteen. His first two albums received critical acclaim, but they were commercial flops. The label gave Springsteen one more shot, and he took it seriously. He spent months in the studio on strenuous recording sessions. On August 25th, 1975, Springsteen released a cinematic album grappling with disillusionment, loneliness, and the quest for freedom. The album became Springsteen's first big commercial success, and it cemented his status as a prolific American songwriter and storyteller. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Veteran character actor Jerry Adler has died at the age of 96. That's according to a funeral home in New York. Adler gained fame with roles on HBO's The Sopranos, as well as the TV series The Good Wife. Before his TV work, Adler was a Broadway stage manager and director. Adler did not turn to acting himself until he was in his 60s. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It is 8:06. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. We also thank UPM Blend and Paper, integrating bio and forest industries into a sustainable and innovation-driven future. More information at upmpaper.com. Coming up in a few moments, we're going to talk about literacy and going back to school with Matt Gross, superintendent of Grand Rapids Area Schools, and the district's literacy lead, Carol Kopp. It's coming up in just a few. Right now, some new music from Minnesota band The Honey Dogs.
Would you be mine? Water protector? Would you be mine?
That is new music from Minnesota group The Honey Dogs. The album is called Algebra for Broken Hearts, and that song was called Attic Brain. And joining us now from Grand Rapids Area Schools, our ISD 318 Superintendent Matt Gross and the district's literacy lead, Carol Kopp. They are here to talk about resilience, readiness, and excellence as we are preparing for another school year. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with a real easy question, I hope, because it is our question of the week, and I think this ties in. What books did you guys enjoy reading when you were kids or reading to kids? That's another fun thing.
I'll let you go first.
Okay. Two books that stand out to me when I was a young child. The first one is Frederick by Leo Leone, and it's the story of a mouse that goes through this long winter, and he gets through this long winter by storing colors and images in his mind, and when the winter drags on, his friends rely on him to share that color and to get through that. And I'm not sure exactly why I like that book so much, but I think it just has to do with hope and resilience, which is something I think we'll talk about today. So I really love that book as a kid. And then the other one is a classic, Where the Wild Things Are, by Marie Sendak. The story of adventure, the story of home, the story of that warm bowl of soup. I think there's just some comfort and adventure that all wrap up into that cool, cool book.
Yeah, I feel that one's so relatable, as, you know, remembering as a kid the times you were upset and then you get to go back home. And
I love it. I love talking about books. Thank you. So for me, when I was a kid, it was the Encyclopedia Brown series, you know, and again, going back to that adventure and mystery, et cetera. I still love that now. And then with my daughter, who was a reader from a very young age, but she loved The Bad Case of the Stripes. Little girl wouldn't eat her lima beans. And the whole book goes through what happens to her and all the different things. So it's just exciting. Books are exciting, take you to a new world. And that's what I love about getting back to school.
Yeah, school starts 1 week from tomorrow.
That's right.
Correct?
Yep.
So how have teachers been preparing?
Absolutely. I'll take that. So our teachers, so a falsehood is that teachers take the summer off and that's all they're doing. Now, I hope that's what they did, a lot of that this summer, but there've been a lot of training. So in the district office, which is the old Southwest, people still get lost trying to find it. We've had teachers in pretty much the whole month of August. A couple of weeks ago, we had over 60 teachers come in voluntarily for a writing training. And they were learning how to do new things with their students to make sure that they're able to do that. We've had all kinds of required trainings getting ready. Teachers have been in their classrooms getting ready. We did not have building switches this year. So last year we had the grade level building switch. We didn't have that this year. Just this week, we have lots of trainings. We're back at it tomorrow morning. We start at the high school. We're really excited about that. We get to hear the famous Grand Rapids marching band. And then teachers will get back in their classrooms and meetings and start getting things ready. And then we have open houses Thursday afternoon at various schools. So there's just been a lot going on. On Friday afternoon, I was just telling Mr. Gross, we had about $100,000 worth of brand new books coming in, because teachers didn't have enough for each student to have in the classroom. So we met that need, and we were sorting at the district office and taking care of everything they needed.
Yeah, great. So how can parents prepare their kids? They've got just over a week to like kind of shift from summer mode to school mode. Is there anything parents can be doing on that front?
Yeah, I think, you know, school is about routine, getting back into routines, right? And that's one of the things that all our great teachers do. They establish routines in their classroom. That sort of sense creates a sense of stability and expectation. And I think for parents this next week, it's talking to their children about getting back into a routine. What time are the children going to bed? Getting back under normal routine for getting to bed, get a jump start on that. You know, if they wait till Monday night to try and do that, it's going to be hard. And so getting kids back into routines, talking to them about school and expectations, talking to them about the bus, if they're going to be riding the bus in, what that's going to be like. The open house is coming up, like Carol said, this Thursday. It's a great time for kids to get into their schools, see their rooms, meet their teachers, and that just helps bring down a sense of anxiety for kids, too, that maybe are feeling a little bit weird about going to school. But one of the things that we're really focused on is readiness, and we want to be ready for our kids, and we want them to feel like, you know, this is what we do. We're ready for you. We want families to feel that way. We're ready for your children, and we're excited.
That's what I wanted to just to add to that was routine is really important. I remember when my daughter was in school and we would start having those early bedtimes a week or two ahead of time because we've been on summer mode the whole time. Just routines and making sure that because the first day of school, it can be scary, especially if you're in a brand new school. Students going from the middle school to the high school, that's a big transition too. And just helping them through that, being able to maybe go walk the school ahead of time, walk the schedule, things like that. Just making sure that communication is key and you're not waiting until the last minute. Because we're ready. Teachers are ready. We're wanting everyone back. The beginning of school year is so exciting for all of us even. And this is my first year not starting in the classroom, and it's still exciting for me to be able to see that.
Good. You wanted to talk about resilience. What can we say about resilience in a school year?
Yeah, one of the things that we've done in the last 6 months is we needed to update our website. So we started talking about that because our platform was expiring. And we started talking about who we are as part of that process because we were looking at our visual identity as well. And three words came to the surface. Resilience was the first one. Readiness was the second one I mentioned. And excellence was the third. So resilience is this idea that we can adapt. We can change. We can do really, really hard things. And I think over the last few years, we've seen that. We certainly demonstrated that during the pandemic, that we could make changes, get through hard things. And really, it's about doing those things together in partnership, whether that's partnership with families, partnership with kids, partnership with our peers. But we can do hard things. And these are, you know, resilience is something that we believe we model, but we also are aspiring to.
Yeah. A lot of school districts have been dealing with, you know, some budget issues, and Grand Rapids schools are not unique to that. But I think a lot of people are probably wondering, will there be a referendum coming up to help with that, or what are the plans there?
Yeah, I think when we talk about resilience, it's a great topic to, you know, lead into finances. We've gone through some really, really challenging years. We've been making reductions for 6 straight years, and that's hard. This spring, most of the school districts in the state did. And this fall, we're going to see a huge number of students running of schools running referendums. We're not going to be running a referendum in November as much as we need to. We're just not ready as a community for that. And there's a lot of conversations that need to happen. And so our school board committed in May to lean into community engagement. And so we're going to be having a lot of meetings over the next year just to listen to our community to find out what it is that our community would like us to do moving forward, because our situation's not going to change without some of those conversations and having a sense of, are we going to continue to try to do less, or are we going to make some investments into schools so that we can compete with our neighbors?
What are some ways the community at large can be supportive of the work the school district is doing, you know, non-financially? You know, a lot of people, they're like, well, I don't have kids in the district. You know, my son just graduated. I'm no longer, you know, a parent of a kid in the district. But what can people do to be supportive of the work the school district's trying to do?
You want me to do that one?
Sure.
In a lot of ways. I was thinking about that this weekend. Strong communities have strong school districts. If you look around, we have an amazing school district here, and I've said it and I'll say it anywhere, is that our school district, our staff, our teachers are some of the best in the state. And we've actually had people from other parts in the state come up to see some of the things that we're doing. But the way the community could get involved, we do have one thing starting this year through Community Ed. So everybody got that Community Ed booklet in the mail. There's a community conversations part in there that's through our district, and they're free sessions and different things for this time to sign up for, to come in and listen to talks about our finances, talks about attendance, how do we help our students, just to get more involved that way, to hear and to know. Another part is to come and or watch school board meetings. School board meetings are a pretty lonely place unless there's something controversial on the docket. And then if you do have students in the district, get involved by talking to your teacher. How can I help? Asking questions. We at the district office are always available to answer questions and to sit down and talk. And it's better to do that than to maybe have some misinformation out there. We have a great school district. We have great teachers. We have great kids and we have great families. And so we just all need to come together to support our district.
I would just add too that especially for folks that don't have children in school anymore, it really becomes a question of values. As a community, what is it that we value and what do we believe makes a community have vitality? I think having strong healthcare systems, I think having strong schools, I think having strong public safety and infrastructure, I think having libraries, I think having parks and recreation, I think having strong business community. Those are all things that make for community vitality, and they come down to values at some point. And people went before us, and I think the phrase gets used quite a bit of we're standing on other people's shoulders, and we're standing currently on the shoulders of people who helped make this region what it is. Going back hundreds of years, people that sacrificed to come here and build this community, build schools, pay for things that set us up to have the life we have now. And eventually it becomes our turn to do the same for the next generation. And so, again, that comes back to values and, in some cases, sacrifice and thinking about other people ahead of yourself. And that's really hard. But I think that's what's made our country great, is putting other people ahead of ourselves and making sacrifices.
That is Grand Rapids Area Schools Superintendent Matt Gross, also joining us. Carol Kopp, Curriculum Integration Specialist.
And district literacy lead. Budget cuts have had people wear multiple hats. So, yes.
Yeah. With the Grand Rapids Area Schools, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
One, two, three, four. What I could have told you, but I don't believe I've the balls to let you know. I can say that 'cause I'm a man, but I feel like a little boy today.
I cherish my intercontinental friendships. We talk it over continental breakfast in a hotel in East Bumble, wherever.
Somewhere on the sphere around here. I cherish my intercontinental friendships. Not much very big on enemies. So I kick a can way up into the sun, man. But it falls down into a ravine. I don't mean to even think about it that way, but I do.
Watching the waves come. An inhabitant of some holy ghost.
I walk like a bruised ego along shorefront property unknown to me.
But I'm feeling inferior on the interior.
Don't you see?
Guarded and sentimental.
And after all, it's just a rental.
Like better luck performing telekinesis on a priestess.
You won't believe what I might have, could have told you. But I wouldn't want to leave you tripping out over it. Okay, more so me, but or just me.
Watching the waves come in at night from my back porch to porch swing, swinging on its own. See, it's just an inhabitant of some holy ghost. We talk it over continental breakfast in a hotel in East Bumble, wherever.
Somewhere on the sphere, around here.
That is music from Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile with Continental Breakfast from their album that came out back in 2017. We will just have Courtney Barnett at Grand Rapids Riverfest, not Kurt Vile, but excited to see her along with Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk coming right up Saturday, September 6th. Find your tickets and more info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. I would love to hear your answers to our question of the week. What books did you enjoy reading as a child? Text us 218-326-1234. Also, our request line, songs about reading and writing. You can text in those as well, 218-326-1234. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. And we thank Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their energy forward strategy. More at mmpower.com/energyforward. Taking a look at our weather for today, looks to be a beautiful day. Sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, northwest winds 5 to 15. Partly cloudy, lows 41 to 45 tonight, and tomorrow mostly sunny, warming up a bit, high 71 to 76, and by Wednesday warming up even a bit more, mostly sunny, 75 to 80, with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month at 9:30. Hikes are 1 hour long. Dogs are welcome on a leash. Support for KAXE comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Collier, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon, it's On the River. It's a great mix of music. Your hosts today are Todd and Tiffany. Coming up 7 o'clock, another edition of On the River, Marie Debris, your volunteer host this evening. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marley Call. There's an opening reception Thursday, September 4th, from 4 to 7 at the gallery, located in Bridgman Hall on the BSU campus. This exhibit looks back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works. It will be on display through October 30th. And the Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Alcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of the many sky pilots during the logging era. Right now, it's time for a special edition of the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The data center construction boom remains on Minnesota's radar with new environmental protections in place, but two cities face lawsuits with claims they are falling short in getting a read on how much future projects would drain natural resources. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy this week took legal action against the cities of Lakeville and North Mankato, arguing local leaders did not follow state law under the environmental review process when advancing projects. Evan Mulholland, staff attorney at the center, says the evaluations left a lot to be desired.
We don't know how much water they're going to use. For energy, we don't know where the energy is going to come from. We don't know whether they're going to have contracts for clean energy, for carbon-free energy or not. All of these things are just missing.
He pointed out the public is also left in the dark about potential noise when equipment is running to store digital data and keep computing machines cool. This spring, state lawmakers extended tax breaks to lure more centers, along with tougher environmental regulations. Advocates said the safeguards are a good step, but not enough. When reached for comment, North Mankato officials say they led an open review process. Data centers are known for massive water consumption and pushing energy demand higher. In some cases, developers request to implement backup diesel generators, potentially adding to their carbon footprint. Mulholland stressed they are not against such facilities, recognizing the need to accommodate digital use in everyday life. He emphasized they are seeking transparency when measuring the environmental impact.
Some of these cities have signed non-disclosure agreements with the developer, and it's becoming an obstacle for the public to understand what it is being proposed to be built.
North Mankato officials said they were looking at different types of development, prompting a broad review without specific details. But the lawsuit contended city staff used the term data center in emails when discussing the matter. The plaintiffs are requesting a stop to project activity, including permitting, until a more detailed environmental assessment is done. It's a burden many Minnesota parents can relate to, struggling to afford childcare or finding an open slot. Now, a decades-old idea to create equal access around the country is getting another look. The U.S. childcare system is often described as broken, with states and local governments pursuing a patchwork of solutions, along with limited federal subsidies for low-income households. The nonprofit think tank, the Roosevelt Institute, led a new report calling for a, quote, public option approach with stronger federal investments to close gaps. Lena Billick, a program manager for the Institute, said despite the urgency, attempts to solve this crisis for working parents have been uneven at best.
We keep tinkering around the edges, but, you know, what we really need is for childcare to be a public good.
The author suggested, like public schools, there should be a universal network of care sites to guarantee free slots without means testing. Instead of subsidies and tax credits, they called for a big boost in federal aid for providers so they can expand and hire staff and keep costs down. The policy push traces back to the 1970s, but has faced political resistance along the way. On average, childcare costs account for nearly 19% of a Minnesota family's income. While this idea still has opponents, elected leaders from all parties have filed bipartisan bills in response to the childcare shortage. The Economic Security Project is a partner in the report. Taylor Joe Eisenberg, executive director of the nonprofit Economic Security Project, is among those who see it as an infrastructure investment to help the economy by keeping parents in the workforce.
And so I think understanding these as tools, not just to meet the needs of families right now, but as a kind of foundation of a healthy, dynamic economy and country is a really important part of the story.
Some of the national pushback against a universal system suggests it would erode the quality of care. Billick countered one of their recommendations strongly advises against provisions like deregulation.
A trend around the country is sort of changing adult-to-child ratio rules to deal with the shortage of staff. Now, that might sound okay, but then you picture a room, we're talking literal babies or infants that need care, and you need a lot of adults for that.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. Also, the latest edition of the Up North Report can be heard this evening, 5:30, during All Things Considered here at KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. We are going to continue now with some news from Morning Edition. We'll hear about Ground Zero at Hurricane Katrina 20 years later, and also about a visit between South Korean presidents and the United States.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Hurricane Katrina was one of those moments that changed people's lives so much that they think of their lives in two parts, before and after the storm. Friday marks 20 years since Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, eventually killing almost 1,400 people. Later this week, we look at how the storm reshaped New Orleans. Today, we revisit Waveland, Mississippi, which took a direct hit. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
To understand the 30-foot wall of water that Katrina pushed into Waveland, Mississippi, sit down with Police Chief Michael Prendergast. He'll tell you how officers who had hunkered down during the height of the storm had to fight their way out of the police department.
When the water started coming in the PD, we couldn't get out.
The force of the water was so strong that the doors wouldn't open, and the windows had been boarded up.
So we had to get a couple of big chairs and bust out the glass of the window, and then wound up beating the board off of the front of the building.
They formed a human chain and floated up as the water rushed in, then swam out the window, hoping to find higher ground. But everything around them was inundated, and this was about 3 miles inland. Prendergast, assistant chief at the time, says they were treading water. Some of them climbed atop the roof. He and others clung to a row of crepe myrtles out front, waves lashing around them.
Everybody, like, hung on to the trees. You know, the guys were, like, just shivering. So we, like, hugged on each other, tried to keep each other warm and, you know, everybody, like, mentally stable.
It was 4 or 5 hours before the water receded, he says, and everyone made it. 27 people. Then the reality of what they were up against set in.
It was kind of like an apocalypse.
That's Lisa Parker, the chief's administrative assistant, the same job she had in 2005. Nearly everyone on the police force had lost their homes and belongings, and they had no equipment either.
We're the ones who're supposed to keep the law and order, and everybody's coming to us for help because that's what you do. But, you know, we were in the same boat as everybody else. You only had so much things you can do with no means to do it. No guns, no radios, no cars, no anything.
Katrina didn't discriminate.
Chief Prendergast.
Rich, poor, didn't matter, you know, how you lived or whatever. Katrina, like, wiped out the whole city.
A local museum is now dedicated to telling Waveland's experience.
Here, we were ground zero.
Bernie Cullen is the chairperson of the aptly named Ground Zero Museum, marking where Katrina made landfall, slamming the city with a 3-story storm surge.
Look at that. That is an aerial view of Waveland. There's nothing, you know, absolutely nothing, you know.
How long do you think it took before, when you were
You know, driving around town, it felt like home again.
Oh, isn't that a great question? Years, just years.
She says the community would grasp onto small signs of hope, like when Walmart reopened.
There's always hope, even in the bleakest times. You know, you take one day at a time, you say, I'm going to rebuild.
But not everyone came back. In the decades after the storm, Waveland lost nearly 20% of its population, which was 7,800 before Katrina. You still see empty slabs dotting neighborhoods, and the downtown business district is mostly empty.
That sense of Main Street USA is missing.
My name is Jay Trapani, and I'm the mayor of the city of Waveland, Mississippi.
He says the recovery here has been a long slog.
90% of the city was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina. I remember driving in from where I evacuated and hearing on the radio it would take 10 years for the coast to come back. And here we are sitting at 20 and we're still trying to recover.
One factor has been stricter building requirements for the high flood risk here that makes construction more expensive. For instance, he says he had to rebuild his beachfront house on concrete pilings 24 feet above sea level. Trapani says getting local businesses back would help, recalling what used to be here.
We had 3 restaurants, a couple of bar rooms. We had a post office, a bank, a gas station, convenience store, liquor store, laundromat, all in this 3-block area. And it's taken a long time. But right now, we got a lot of things in the works.
Katrina also wiped away cultural treasures in Waveland, including the United Methodist Gulfside Assembly, founded a century ago as a sprawling waterfront retreat for African Americans. Executive Director Cheryl Thompson says it was a gut punch to find nothing left. No hotel or chapel or auditorium or anything.
It hit Gulfside like a brick wall. There was essentially nothing there. You know, it was felt like a relative or somebody I knew had died. It was just very emotional.
Thompson grew up in New Orleans and spent her childhood summers at Gulfside Assembly, which she says was an anchor for the Black community in the segregated South.
There were no other places for us to go where we felt free, to stay in the hotel, to swim in the water, to have our own place. You know, there weren't places where we could go to stay in hotels. I'm 77 years old, and so when I was growing up, that was not a thing. And so it was special to my family.
It was a place for weddings, reunions, and civil rights strategy meetings, she says. 20 years after Katrina, the organization is still struggling to regroup and working out of a donated church building.
You grieve, but we have to move on. You know, it's not going to be what it was before, but we can still do our ministry.
Part of that ministry is a Sunrise Katrina Remembrance Service on the anniversary Friday, overlooking the Gulf from a newly built pavilion at Gulfside Assembly. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Waveland, Mississippi.
This is NPR News.
Recently, federal funding for all public media was cut. Besides those federal cuts, KXE has also received cuts from the state of Minnesota for programming you love. We wanted to hear from listeners why they think it's important to show their support for KXE right now.
Hi, my name is Dave, and I'm a supporter of KXE, and we have lived in 50 Lakes area for about 3 years and loved the music and the news and all the Northern radio shows. And it's become vitally important to us in the car and at home to get our news and music from KAXE. So that's why we feel it's important to keep you guys on the air as long as you want to be on the air. So
make your donation now to help KAXE stay on the air. Go to our website, kaxe.org, and click the word donate.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump will meet with the president of South Korea for a summit in Washington today.
The two countries' longtime alliance is on the table. They're expected to work out the final details of a trade deal and discuss the role of U.S. forces stationed in South Korea.
NPR correspondent Anthony Kuhn joins us now for a preview of this meeting. So, Anthony, the South Korean president took office in June. Tell us about him.
Well, his name is Lee Jae-myung. He's a 61-year-old former human rights lawyer who later served as mayor and provincial governor. 3 years ago, he narrowly lost the presidential election to his predecessor, Yoon Song-yeol. Then last December, Yoon declared martial law over South Korea. And Lee led the charge to defeat the martial law and then get Yoon impeached, and then Lee won snap elections. And in order to become president, he sort of moved his liberal politics more towards the center. He still emphasizes diplomatic engagement with North Korea and China over military deterrence of them.
Okay, so I remember last month a verbal trade deal was reached between the U.S. and South Korea. So what still needs to be worked out?
A lot. It's a pretty spare framework. One of the key points is that South Korea has pledged to invest $350 billion in the U.S., basically as a payment to get tariffs lowered from 25% to 15%. Now, the U.S. has said that President Trump is going to get to pick those investments, and 90% of the profits from the investments will go to the U.S. South Korea says they don't agree with that. They're not making any investments that don't benefit them. And they point out that most of the $350 billion will actually be loans to South Korean companies to make stuff in the U.S. What's clear about this is that the U.S. is counting on South Korea to help it rebuild industrial manufacturing, such as shipbuilding. Lee is going to visit a Korean-invested shipyard in Philadelphia, for example, and they also rely on South Korea to compete with China in high-tech sectors such as semiconductors.
All right, so that's the business end. What about when it comes to a military alliance?
Yeah, the U.S. wants to modernize its 71-year-old alliance with South Korea to focus less on countering North Korea and more on deterring China. Now, on his flight to Washington, President Lee told reporters that this is, quote, not an issue that we can easily agree with. So they've got a major difference in priorities and threat perceptions. South Korea has previously sent troops to Vietnam and Iraq away from the Korean Peninsula. It does not want to be dragged into a conflict with China over, say, for example, Taiwan. China is just too close to South Korea geographically and economically. Remember that South Korea's economy is about the size of Canada's, its landmass is about the size of Indiana, and it's right next to China.
Why didn't Lee visit the United States first? Normally that's what happens with South Korean presidents. They come to the U.S. first.
That's right. Lee instead chose to visit Japan, and he spent much of his time there speaking with Japan's Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba about how to deal with U.S. tariffs. In past, Japan and South Korea used to feud over history. They used to compete with each other for the U.S.'s favor. Now they find they have a lot in common, especially managing the risks of their alliances with the U.S.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn joining us from Seoul. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, A.
The new government of Syria has been looking for ways to improve relations with its neighbor, Israel. That's a big change from the prior Syrian government, a declared enemy of Israel, which was also the host of many Palestinian refugees. NPR's Jane Araf went to Damascus, Syria, to see what's changing.
A man selling cakes from a wooden pushcart makes his way through mostly empty streets in Damascus's Yarmouk camp. Before the Syrian regime put down an uprising in 2011 and ushered in 14 years of civil war, Yarmouk was the biggest Palestinian refugee camp in Syria. It's in ruins now, destroyed mostly by Syrian and Russian airstrikes. There isn't a single building here that hasn't been heavily damaged. Some of them have been destroyed. They're just piles of rubble.
Come on!
Some have hung on, like Salah al-Barhouti. His father was one of tens of thousands of Palestinians who fled to Syria in 1948 with the creation of Israel and was never allowed back. Barhouti is 63. Two of his children were killed in the civil war here, his shop destroyed. But Syria is the only home he has ever known. If we go back to our country, Palestine, he says, what can we do? This is our country too. I was raised here. I was born here. Syria was ruled for more than 60 years by a party whose founding ideology was intertwined with the struggle for a Palestinian homeland. What's left of the camp remains a testament to the now millions of stateless Palestinians. Amar Hamid, a banker who grew up in the camp, reads fading script on a concrete wall.
Jerusalem, we will return. We shall return.
Syria's toppled president, Bashar al-Assad, and his father, Hafez, considered themselves leaders of resistance against Israel. One might think that Syria's new president, a former Islamic militant, might as well. But Ahmed Ashara has renounced that ideology, and he's taken the extraordinary step of opening the door to ties with Israel. Ashara has made clear that Syria will not pose a threat to Israel. Syrian officials say talk of signing a peace deal is premature. But even the limited measures Syria has taken are a dramatic reversal. In the middle of Damascus is the Palestinian embassy, a set of offices on a quiet street. Ambassador Samir al-Rafai tells us Iran's decline in influence with the fall of the Syrian regime has had a huge impact.
What happened in Syria significantly changed the Palestinian situation and the map of the factions and their alliances.
Rafai says it seems clear there will be a new relationship with Israel.
We observe and do not interfere in the affairs of any Arab country, but we believe that peace is on the horizon. As for what this peace will look like for the Palestinians, we do not know.
You might think that Shara's base of conservative Sunni Muslims would oppose warming up to Israel, particularly during the devastating war in Gaza. But Syrians say they have to focus on their own country now. It's normal. Let us live, says Lama Madwar, a businesswoman, at a recent public celebration. We're exhausted. We want peace. We want to open up the country. In the Sheikh Mahyuddin market in Damascus, Ahmed Atiya, who's 27, works at a butcher shop. He's a third-generation refugee. He says Syrians are very sympathetic to the Palestinians. Palestinian refugees here don't have citizenship, but they have more rights than in many other Arab countries. We go to school together. We go to the same universities in Damascus. There's no discrimination, he says. For most Palestinian refugees, reclaiming their homeland is a dream they still hold on to. But Syria and its move to ties with Israel is the reality. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. It is 8:53. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, I'm sticking around for your Headwaters show, your source for great music. And Monday mornings include our request line. We pick a theme and get your song suggestions. Today, I would like to hear your suggestions, songs about reading or writing. Text us 218-326-1234. Also, our question of the week, what were your favorite books to read as a child or books to read to children? That's fun too. Text us 218-326-1234. Brainerd Women of Today invite all ages to Chalk the Block. That is this morning starting at 9:30. Spread positivity by drawing or writing uplifting messages on Laurel Street. Meet at Passport Restaurant. Also, the Itasca County Family YMCA in Grand Rapids will be closed for plumbing work today through Wednesday. Their outdoor courts will still be available. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We're going to hear some new music now. It's from Josh Ritter. It's called You Won't Dig My Grave.
to be shaken by the frost or by the lateness of the hour. I have lived in consternation of the road ahead for me. Despite that I can't see that far, there are things that I can see. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I've lived among the angels, you never were that brave. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I've been up to the mountain, there are things that you can't take. From that morning by the river, where once I touched her hem, to a midnight in the garden without a solitary friend. The rock of my salvation was the girl who took my hand. You've never been loved the way I have, you wouldn't understand. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I've lived among the angels, you never were that brave. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I've been up to the mountain, there are things that you can't take. My grave, I've lived among the angels, you never were that brave. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I have been off to the mountain, there are things that you can't take. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave. I have lived among the angels, I have lived among the angels. You won't dig my grave, you won't dig my grave.
That is new music from Josh Ritter, You Won't Dig My Grave, here on the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us. We also thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community. Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4- and 5-year-olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th, and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. And tomorrow morning, during the morning show at 8:45, we are going to talk with Michelle Hoffs from Happy Dancing Turtle and learn more about that class. Our temperatures right now, we are in the low to mid 50s throughout the region, 50 in Hibbing and Park Rapids, 54 in Brainerd. That is our range of temperatures for today. Sunny, with highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows 41 to 45, and for Tuesday, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76. Our lows tomorrow night in the low 50s, and looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Remember, our request line theme for this Monday is songs about writing or reading. Text in your suggestions, 218-326-1234. And we hope you can join us for Grand Rapids River Fest.